You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of February 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
Canada knows that an effective European voice on the global stage isn't just preferable, it's essential.
Justin Trudeau's European tour. How much extra applause is he getting for not being Donald Trump? Speaking of whom?
I do get good ratings, you have to admit that. I know what's good and bad. I'd be a pretty good reporter. I can handle a bad story better than anybody. The Rasmussen poll just has me through the roof. I'm actually having a very good time. I'm really not a bad person, by the way. I won.
Following yesterday's eccentric press conference, renewed speculation about President Trump's relationship with verifiable reality. Does the so-called Goldwater rule need rethinking? My guests Chris Lord and Andrew Tuck will be here to discuss that and other stories, including fake news for real as Bild apologizes for reporting a crime by immigrants which was never actually committed, and a new way to send stuff to Tonga, should you wish to. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck, and Monocle's Istanbul bureau chief, Chris Lord. Welcome both. And we will start with the European tour of Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. He was, of course, already popular on this side of the Atlantic, and the election of Donald Trump to the presidency of his country's southern neighbour has made him more so. Yesterday, Trudeau spoke to the European Parliament in Strasbourg and enthused about the stability and prosperity underpinned by the alliance, the imminent departure of its third largest nation notwithstanding. Andrew, Justin Trudeau managed to get through his speech without mentioning either the UK or the United States. Is there a message there, or was he just being diplomatic?
I'm sure he's being diplomatic, but actually there's something very powerful about seeing him rock up at the EU, seeing him with Angela Merkel. You know, at a time when many people are despairing about the future of, you know, liberal democratic leaders and, you know, what can be done, you see these people together and you're reminded that actually all is not lost. They are a generation of political leaders who still believe in doing well for as many people as possible within their nations, who believe that things can get better, who care about race, are not sexist, are not crazies, and who actually aren't too egotistical either. And I think, you know, I think he's an impressive figure. He suffers, unfortunately, the same thing that many female politicians have suffered for generations, in that the populist media cannot help but judge him on his looks. So, you know, so many of the papers today...
It is the burden he carries.
Well, kind of, but it's dull because, you know, I think for him, it's as limiting on him as it is on any female politician who's judged by their looks. So he meets Angela Merkel, and it's, you know, the headlines I've been looking through on the more populist papers today are, you know, Angela Merkel swoons for Trudeau. Even she, you know, goes weak at the knees. Ivanka Trump, you know, goes weak at the knees for Trudeau. And what it does is it belittles the fact that actually he's delivering a very powerful message, which is, you know, that we are a nation of tolerant people, a nation of migrants, a nation that's outward looking, a nation that wants to have trade deals. And I think that many people in the media, in the right-wing media, they do use his looks in a way to kind of make him less of an important figure. And I think, actually, at this time, at this moment, he and, you know, Angela Merkel has many, many problems, but I think they are both interesting leaders for more reasons than their gender or their looks.
Chris, to what extent do you think Justin Trudeau's stature has been enhanced by the election of Donald Trump? To what extent is he now pictured, especially by Europeans, or thought of by Europeans as the anti-Trump?
I mean, I think on one side, you know, he presents a sort of reassuring, I think, as Andrew said, a reassuring, familiar face of a statesman in a sense. And I think a lot of people feel that when they see him talk, the way he builds speeches, the way he conducts himself is a reminder of sort of earlier politicians, you know, before our headlines and our televisions were dominated by the images of very outspoken, railing people. I think Trudeau in one sense, when I read some of the speeches, he's very good at playing to the media. He knows how to talk to the media. He knows how to communicate certain things to them. I think in this case, by not mentioning Brexit, by not directly addressing Trump, he knows what he's doing. He knows that by not doing that, he's somehow playing that media quite cleverly, I would say.
And also, this is a moment, you know, of a celebration for him. This is a moment where Canada and the EU have set up an amazing kind of trading relationship. And, you know, he feels a global statesman. And why should he talk about Brexit? You know, that's a chaotic deal that we don't know where it's going to end up. You know, that the Brits are kind of sticking two fingers up one minute to the EU, the second saying, you know, if you don't do what we want, you'll be in trouble. You know, he's come along and he's shown actually with a bit of calm and empathy and willingness to bend here and there that he can get the deal that he needs. And, you know, that's why he shouldn't mention all these other people shouting from the sidelines, because actually his humanity and tolerance have delivered a deal, whereas other people are going to kind of mess it up because they don't have the same qualities.
Just to follow that up, you describe him as a global statesman. Is he obliged to assume that mantle or an even larger version of that mantle because of the circumstances in which he now finds himself, because the United States is undergoing whatever it's undergoing, because the EU may or may not be fracturing? Does he have to think about playing a larger role than he might have assumed he was going to end up playing when he became the Prime Minister of Canada?
There are some issues which he's not going to be able to change other nations' minds about. You know, oddly, migration, no matter what he does, that's a Canadian story. But, you know, here is Canada probably more affected by climate change than many other nations around the world. And when you have the US officially stepping back from even a belief in climate change, and he knows the consequences for people living in the far north of Canada, for average Canadians, then, of course, there are other fields where it will be, you know, it would be his duty to step up to the plate and say, actually, I will take more of a leadership on these things. And I think especially around climate change and environment, that is his duty.
I think one thing to say on that point, though, I think when it's about how one defines oneself against something else, and I think we've seen lots of other politicians do that, for Angela Merkel being a case in point, you know, people using the looming terrifying image of Trump as a way to decide what are our values, what do we represent as, you know, liberal democracy and so on. And I think Trudeau, and I don't mean this as a criticism, but I do think he has benefited from that. I think when you have that south of the border, you've got this very, for a lot of people, frightening public figure, and then you've got a much more friendlier statesman-like face. I think that's helped his side, I would say.
Well, let's move along to Trudeau's recent host in Washington, President Donald Trump, who yesterday treated the White House press corps to what could be described as a question and answer session, except that it raised rather more of the former than it provided of the latter. Speculation as to whether Trump actually has both oars in the water has been a constant theme of his political career, but in the last 4 weeks has acquired a measure of urgency. Andrew, we run up here against the so-called Goldwater Rule, an American convention named after the somewhat excitable 1964 Republican candidate for president, Barry Goldwater, which prevents psychologists from diagnosing public figures whom they have not sat down and had a consultation with. Do we now need some room for manoeuvre on this?
I would be very slow to try and judge his decisions or to frame his behaviour in terms of mental health. You know, I don't think it's fair for people who suffer genuine mental health issues and they somehow get lumped within him. I think that many of the things that he's doing are down to old-fashioned arrogance, old-fashioned... he's a pugilist. You know, he just is someone who's come up through the business world and believes if you punch your opponents hard enough and often enough, they will go away. And that's what we saw yesterday. His demeanour, his way of behaving is always aggressive. He doesn't realise he's meant to be presidential, or he does. He doesn't give a damn. He is going to carry on as a CEO, as an aggressive CEO who's had many scrapes and many difficulties, but has managed to stay in business because he has, in one way or another, battered many of his opponents through deals and through, you know, sharp behaviour. And he thinks that is the way to go ahead. I'm not that interested in saying that he's mentally unwell. I don't think that's correct. I think he's just, a good old-fashioned, as it were, a nasty old-fashioned, tyrant.
There was an illuminating and, in its way, hilarious letter to the New York Times this week by Alan Francis, the psychologist who defined narcissistic personality disorder, which a lot of people have accused Trump of suffering from. He actually said, Andrew, something quite similar to what you've just said, and I quote, because it is delicious, it is a stigmatizing insult to the mentally ill, who are mostly well-meaning and well-behaved, to be lumped with Mr. Trump, who is neither. I do recommend people look up the letter in its entirety. It is a masterpiece of withering, understated insult. His psychological motivations are too obvious to be interesting, which was my favourite line, I think.
But we should bring Chris, but the funny thing is watching that press conference yesterday. Now, here's the weird divide. Here's a man who said, it's running smoothly, it's an amazingly well-oiled machine, everything is perfection, there's not a thing wrong. And then on the other side, he's saying exactly at the same time, it's chaotic and wrong and being, misjudged because of the press. And so he's both acknowledging it is seen as chaotic while pretending it's not chaotic. But they're only reporting on the events that are happening within the White House. So there is a weird split in his brain where he cannot reconcile the two things which are going on in front of him.
But there are, Chris, there's these weird drifts into outright fantasy as well. And he did get called on one of these yesterday when he was talking about how he'd had the biggest electoral college win since Reagan. And somebody was able to stand up and point out, well, that is simply not true. That is obviously and verifiably inaccurate, to which all he could mutter was, well, that's the information I was given.
But I think because just to bring it back to some of my own experience, I mean, one of the things that's regularly leveled against President Erdogan in Turkey is that he's mentally ill. I mean, that's something that people have postulated before, that some of the behaviour that he's done in the last 13 years of his rule has all the signs of narcissism. His gaffes that he makes that somehow makes him more popular amongst people, veers into unrealities, untruths, and will say them as fact. I mean, these are all things that have happened in Turkey and now are obviously alarmingly happening in the US. I think what I don't like about this sort of idea of mentally ill is that somehow it's an involuntary thing. When we talk about something being mentally ill, that means it's out of your control. And I think that take something away from actually the sort of irrationality of the way Trump is doing is what appeals to a lot of people. I think that is actually what makes him a very, very sort of compelling figure to watch, because it's so irrational. And sort of that irrationality from the start of his campaign was what he used to bring a lot of people on side, to say, I am not the typical politician, I'm not the typical voice. And that's what unfortunately resonates with a lot of people. I think to say mentally ill suggests that somehow this is, the sort of ramblings of somebody who's not completely in control of themselves. And I don't think that's the case. I think this is, in many cases, this is a campaign. This is still he's on the campaign trail.
Andrew, what is your sense of that? Because it is the great, I think it's the key question about Donald Trump. To what extent is anything he's doing conscious and deliberate? Or is this just an entirely instinctive creature maneuvering according to whatever pops into his head at a given moment?
I don't think he's a man without a plan. But within that plan, it's free-ranging. Again, coming back to who he is, what's strange is, again, I was saying we shouldn't judge people on their looks, but here we go. So here's a man who paints his face orange, who has the weirdest haircut, who has a tie that hangs below his crotch, who wears the weirdest suit going. Now, those things are interesting because he thinks we can't see what's behind that. He's a 70-year-old guy whose, looks have gone, and he should kind of face up to it. He should have his hair cut. He should, put on a suit that kind of matches his girth. Now, he's trying to hide all of those things, and it's the same when he comes on stage, and it is a stage for him. When he comes on stage to perform, he thinks we can't see any of the cracks. He thinks that this bluster and this show works. In a way, all of his failed, policies and all of his, attempts at the Muslim ban, they're all covered with a wig. They're all covered with a toupee. They're all covered with a bouffant haircut. They're all smeared with face paint in an attempt to mask something. And he believes that is enough to distract us. But we see through it. We see what's going on. And that's, up until now, until yesterday, I really thought actually, for his supporters, there will never be that chink of light where they think, oh my God, we did elect somebody who's not exactly fit for this role. But after yesterday, you think this cannot run for 4 years. Or if it does, most people will back away from it. I think that, you know, he appeared crazy yesterday.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Andrew Tuck and Chris Lord. Coming up next, real fake news.
Can you smell that popcorn? Well, while you're waiting in line, let me tell you about some of the standout guests we've spoken to recently on The Cinema Show. This year's Palme d'Or winner Ken Loach told us how going back to basics was integral to the strength of his winning film, I, Daniel Blake.
Paul wrote two characters which have quite simple, straightforward situations.
Fellow Palme d'Or winners Jean-Pierre and Luc Dardenne told us how reaching the heights of the film industry can have its downside.
Because after Cannes, the reactions were mixed. Some good, some less good.
And Canadian filmmaker Xavier Dolan gave me a glimpse into his creative process.
What matters in making movies is all the elements are working and walking at once in synchronicity.
So now you've heard the trailer, all you need is the main attraction. Tune in to The Cinema Show on Monocle 24 every Friday at 20:00 in London. Or download the podcast now. You'd better hurry with that popcorn though. The movie's about to start.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Andrew Tuck and Chris Lord. Time now for some fake news news. The somewhat excitable German Daily Bild has apologised to its readers for a story it ran about a mob of men of Arab appearance sexually assaulting women in a Frankfurt restaurant on New Year's Eve. This crime does not, upon further investigation, appear to have occurred at all whatsoever in the slightest. Andrew, the apology says this reporting in no way reflects the journalistic standards of Bild. Can this possibly have been an honest mistake?
I doubt that it were. Well, it's probably one of those stories that came in, they didn't bother to verify it in the way that it should be done, they got carried away. And it's certainly reprehensible and terrible that this story ran, and it feeds into all sorts of people's fears and builds up racism. But let's just be honest about this. This is a very complicated story for German media, because when we did have genuine attacks over the past year, 2 years, there have been many instances where the German press has felt that it is not their job to cover those stories. And on the other side of the story, we're concerned that by covering any of these attacks by migrants on other German citizens, that they would somehow be, you know, stepping over a line that they shouldn't step over. So there's a weird story. There's on one side an underreporting, a failure to report, and then on the other side this sensationalism. But what it leaves at the end of the day is a terrible feeling that the German media is just not fit and ready to cover these stories one way or the other. And I think it's down to all of the newspapers to be a little bit more honest about what's going on and to come back to some proper journalistic value. So I think this is an awful, awful story. But in a way, I wonder if it's not connected to the other side of the story when we've had attacks that haven't been reported and they got carried away because they felt suddenly they'd been charged up to do this.
Chris, how many people do you think who read the original story and believed it, because why wouldn't you, are either not going to entirely believe the apology or will never hear the apology, and you know, and this attack which never happened will pass into folklore? I'm thinking also of the recent poll which suggested it was quite a hefty number of Republican voters who specifically thought that Trump's travel ban was justified by the Bowling Green massacre.
Well, I mean, we've seen all the way throughout the Trump campaign, fake news and misinformation spiral, as you say, into a kind of a half-life that lives well beyond the story itself. But I mean, I think in this case, I mean, there was sort of an apology that came out shortly afterwards by Bild. And I think what really has to happen, it has to be an investigation on how on earth does that happen? How do you have a major German publication bury such an extraordinarily horrible story into the public realm? How does that become part of an accepted story that gets reported in that way? I think rather than just an apology now, there almost needs to be a report on the prosecution process, on the investigation process. How do we actually make sure that something like that doesn't happen again?
Can I just give you a strange story as a sidestep? You know, of course, it's concerning that, you know, these newspapers feed into our fears, but our fears then become so embedded and are so kind of oddly, they're not just down to newspapers. A tiny example, I live in a neighbourhood where we had a couple of, you know, incidents with young kids kind of stealing motorbikes and things. So I went along to a meeting and there was a police chief there and he said, okay, in the area I live, which, you know, probably includes hundreds of thousands of people, he said to the people, how many burglaries do you think happen here every night? And someone put up their hand and they said 300. And someone else put their hand up and they said 50. And, you know, there was, you know, it went around. He said, on average, in a night, we may have 5 burglaries. And often those turn out not to be burglaries. Someone broke a window because they didn't have their keys on them. Now, those fears have now become so embedded within us about race and about being attacked that you don't need a newspaper to fear that. You know, if you said to people, do you think, how many attacks do you think happen on women from migrants every night? They will give you a figure that's not based on news. The fear has been built into so many people now that this is why fake news is so successful, because, you know, you have this sediment of terror in people, and you just have to say something and people will believe it. It does. The attack doesn't have to happen, and people will imagine it's happening every night. And that is, you know, we're not going to talk about Mark Zuckerberg today, but he began to address this yesterday. This fake news thing, this feeding the fear of whatever side of the political spectrum you sit on, is so successful that you don't have to have a story. You don't have to have an attack. It is just believed by people now to be happening.
Okay, well, let's move along now to Tonga. A dateline we don't consider nearly often enough. It's shortly to acquire its first formal postal system with the aid of the British technology company What Three Words. Their system divides the planet into squares of 3 metres by 3, each endowed with a unique combination of three words. If I have understood the thing correctly, we are currently broadcasting from Serve to Muse Quit. I'm joined as well now by another three words, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Fernando, is our addressing system actually that outmoded and inefficient? Does this work better?
No, I don't think so. And actually, to be honest, I don't know how Tongans are living. You know, I'm sorry if they're really having a big problem, but I don't think it's charming, actually. You know, imagine if you live in a heart beer cloud, let's say random three words. I honestly think, you know, whatever the system they had, even if it was like under, you know, close to the convenience shop or something like that, I think that might work better.
But you say that. I have looked this up. I think I actually live at Gent Melon Field.
I mean, I wouldn't mind living there. That's nice. Nice. I'll pop round.
Imagine if I would live in avocado raising racism, things that I hate. I would have to move my house.
Okay, you know? Could I? Oh, yeah. Because it's easy to kind of knock these people. Here's my kind of sticking up for them. What's the fascinating thing is, do you know there are millions and millions and millions of people who don't have an address?
4 billion, according to what three words.
Okay. So, you know, the notion that you are beyond connectivity, you know, we're concerned about this in the digital world, and everyone is saying that everyone in the end should be connected to the digital world because that is education, that is, you know, a sense of understanding, although we've just been talking about how you may get screwed up by it as well. But, you know, if you live in, like, you know, a remote part of, you know, I don't know, Congo or Zambia, and you don't have an address, here's an amazing thing. I can now post you a letter, and in theory, it will get to you in the next few days, wherever you live.
Do you know, I used to be one of those people without an address. So when I used to live in Dubai for quite some time, and despite all the futurism and sort of rampant construction that's happened there, they've still been unable to give everybody an address. So you cannot have anything delivered to your house, and I relied on PO boxes for God knows how long. But one of the things that struck me with this what three words, these words that we're all talking about, I mean, they're not particularly simple words, are they? I mean, like, one of the ones it had in regards to Tonga was international bashfully placidity. I mean, like, putting that onto an envelope and getting it all spelt right perfectly, because it's all going into one big machine that's going to work out where you are. So you've got to be able to spell bashfully while standing up in the post office.
Although I also quite like the fact that in some countries, you know, people are very good at just adopting words anyway. When I went to Botswana once, and there people have a habit of taking on a non-Botswana name because they like it. So they would choose names, but oddly not kind of other Christian names. So we were travelling around with a guy, and the driver was called Custard. Now, he had just looked in the dictionary and found a word that he kind of liked, and he thought, I'll call myself Custard. And I thought that was actually a great name. And just two other things on maps. It's also quite useful in Beirut, where often there is such a higgledy-piggledy way of doing addresses, that you say, it's the third house past the mosque, past the swimming pool. That's the address, and even if you were trying to have it delivered. And in Japan, where often buildings go up and the last building goes up takes the next number, so you'll be on a street where it's never numerical in going up one side down the other. You know, 1 and 900 could be next to each other and 2 could be at the other end of the road. So
well, finally tonight we're moving into the field of numismatics. I think that's the right word. This is prompted by the fact that Australia, my home country, has unveiled a new $10 note. It again features Banjo Paterson, the poet, and also the poet Dame Mary Gilmore, who actually once literally wrote a poem about one of my great-great-grandfathers.
Wow. What was his name?
His name was Charles Buffery.
What rhymes with Buffery?
Nothing. The poem itself didn't rhyme, but he was, he became famous for riding a white bull down the main street of Wagga Wagga to win a bet.
There's lots of good rhymes in there.
Dame Mary Gilmore wrote a poem about it. This is an entirely true story. But we are here to discuss the utility or sense or otherwise of putting famous people rather than other famous things on banknotes. Because how many of you know who's on the British £10 note right now without looking at it?
Charles Darwin. Yeah,
it is Charles Darwin.
Fiver. Who's on the fiver?
Oh, I don't know. Is it the Queen?
You can't say the Queen.
No,
she's on all
no,
of them.
No. It's Winston.
Oh, Winston Churchill.
Oh my God, yeah. Have you heard of him?
Once.
You've been in Turkey too long, Chris.
I have. Where it's very simple because there's only one man on the notes.
But,
Ataturk.
But Fernando, Brazil does not do this.
We like to avoid any sort of controversy, so we decided to do a celebration of our animals, actually, in the notes. So, you know, I think it's quite a good idea.
I like
actually.
That. I think that's nice.
So, for example, I have actually some notes here. The 100 reais note, which is the biggest one, is the garoup or garupa, you know.
A grouper. I think we call it a grouper fish in
the grouper fish. They live about 50 years and, you know, very traditional Brazilian fish. On the 50 reais note, we have a jaguar. Very beautiful one, actually. I mean, actually, it became a bit tacky, actually. The 20 reais one is a golden lion monkey.
I would love one of them in my house. They're quite nice. They're
very nice. But the 10 real is my favorite. A red macaw. I mean, it's amazing. And 5 real is a bit boring. It's an egret. But I think it's a good idea. We avoid controversies. I mean, because, you know, if we choose a hero, you know, imagine if he had a controversial past, you know, there'd be a lot of... Even though some people are complaining that we don't have an anteater in the notes as well. So that's...
I think that's outrageous that you have spurned the anteater.
Yeah, I think so as well, but let's see. I would swap the egret for the...
In Australia, we do have animals on the coins, just not on the banknotes.
You do have a platypus.
I think that thing about sort of controversial figures on banknotes, I think that's quite an interesting point, isn't it? I mean, you know, for example, Winston Churchill being a case in point. You know, and of course, lots of people, lots of great things about Winston Churchill, but also lots of complicated things.
Don't get all lefty on us now. I think Churchill's fine. Mr. Trump's put him back in the office. I thought that was all positive PR at the moment for Mr. Churchill.
That is very true.
I think Australia's good as well because you've led the way in kind of washable notes. Because
the plastic banknote, I believe, is an Australian invention.
Yeah, and we've now got them here in the UK. And they've just decided this week that actually, despite the fact that they've got tallow in them, which was made from animal products, they're gonna bring out the next plastic notes. So vegans are kind of, they're distressed.
But the few British surfers are really happy.
Yeah, but you just have to kind of tap and pay if you're a vegan these days. Yeah,
would you prefer the token British people at the table to see British animals, British fauna adorning your banknotes?
We've got some good animals. The dormouse, maybe. I like the dormouse. Hedgehog. We're prickly every now and then.
A red squirrel.
Well, there's not many of those left, so that would have to be on like the £50 one, wouldn't it?
Yeah, like very rare.
Okay. Yeah, I wouldn't mind an animal or a badger.
The badger. The stoat.
Stoat's nice. Yeah.
Should we just name every British animal?
Can I suggest Kingfisher for the £100? Oh, there's no £100.
There's no £100.
Sorry.
If there was, Fernando, it would be the Kingfisher.
We could invent one.
And also here in the UK, we're just about to get the new pound coin, 12-sided, and everyone who's got a current pound coin in their pocket, you have to get rid of it by then because they're going to be illegal.
So spend, spend, spend is the closing message. That is all we have time for. Andrew Tuck, Chris Lord, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you very much for joining us. The show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Anthea Longo. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. Music next, 1900, it's Marcus Hippie with The Menu. Stay tuned for the cinema show at the Berlin Film Festival. That's at 2000, and The Daily returns at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time on Monday, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.